Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by conservative commentator Dan Proft, liberal professor Mark Casello, and Illinois Tea Party leader Tim Krolaitis. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's www.beyondthebeltway.com. A little bit later on in the broadcast, we're going to be talking about the 125th anniversary of the Haymarket riots in Chicago, and they really set the stage for what has become known worldwide as May Day. It's the focal point where the celebration of labor is really celebrated all over the world, and we're going to be talking this evening about the relationship between the American labor movement and where we are politically, sort of in the wake of the focus on the state of Wisconsin and what's happening on the broader labor movement, not just exclusively public employee unions, but unions and the power of unions and business as we head towards the presidential election. But first of all, I want to talk a little bit about, as we have for the last several weeks, what's happening in the race for 2012. Last night at the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner, President Obama was there. He took his opportunity, used his opportunity in the spotlight to really skewer Donald Trump, who was also in the audience. Donald Trump, once again, for this past week, pretty much has dominated a Republican primary talk. And I want to get reaction and spend a couple of segments talking about the Donald and the likelihood of him becoming the Republican nominee. Dan Proft is our card-carrying conservative Republican tonight. My first question to you about, with all the publicity about what the president had to say about Donald Trump last night, do you think that the president maybe elevated Trump in some way by spending so much time talking about him?
No, I don't really think so. I think they recognize a easy target when they see one, a target that they can go after and not be perceived as being shrill or overly partisan. And because Trump is such a sideshow, he is the perfect patsy for the president to utilize, as he did.
Mark Casello is our liberal this evening. Your response to the same question.
Yeah, I think, as I said last week, Trump is a darling of the media. He's easy to cover, but I think Dan's right on this point that Obama would love to run against a Trump. I think he's an easy target. I think he's got a lot to pick apart. And because public sentiment, I mean, Donald Trump has such an ego, like when he came out earlier this week and said, I'm very proud of myself. And when I was in my helicopter, these kinds of things don't make him maybe a darling of the average American.
Speaking of the average American, a lot of Tea Party people fall into that category. He has been speaking for the last couple of weeks, several weeks. I'm talking about Donald Trump. He's been speaking about an issue that many in the Tea Party feel is important, and that's the birther issue. Mm-hmm. And he forced the president, as he took credit for it, forcing the president to come forward with his birth certificate this past week. Mm-hmm. So what are the Tea Party people thinking and saying about Donald Trump?
You know, Trump is Trump. So, you know, he's kind of a almost a walking cartoon character, I would say. But something interesting is going on. I think he's getting to our president. For example, when they most of what happens at these this luncheon would be that it's self-deprecating humor. The president usually makes fun of himself a lot of times. And I think what happened is you saw some of President Obama's mean-spiritedness come out and go after Trump. And I think he's got it didn't look very presidential as far as I'm concerned. And I think he basically maybe brought out the community organizer out in our president.
One of the things that Donald Trump has been saying before the birth certificate was released by the White House, what he has been saying, he's been criticizing Obama, and he's been pointing to Obama, that Obama and his handlers have been spending a lot of time and money worrying about this issue. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the reasons why he was out there saying what he had to say. Mm-hmm. So at this particular point, does Donald Trump get credit, if credit is to be given, for forcing the release of this birth certificate? Which, I mean, by the way, I know has never been a big issue to you or me. Mm-hmm. We haven't spent much time talking about it on the show. But was he not responsible for getting at least the release of the certificate?
I really don't care. I mean, if we can give him credit and that means he'll fold up his circus tent and go away, then I'm happy to give him all the credit in the world, because he's just a sideshow. He's a distraction. Three quarters of the American people do not see him as a serious candidate, and those three quarters of the people are correct. And the great thing about this birth certificate issue coming out this week is now we can dispense with that ancillary issue and focus in on something Barack Obama has never had to do, which is defend his record. Mm-hmm. Focus in on the last 3 years of his presidency. That is the reason that Republicans are going to win, presenting a contrast to what Barack Obama has done. And they need to have a laser-like focus. And the birth certificate issue is a distraction. Donald Trump is a distraction. These are serious times. The Republicans need to put up a serious candidate. Donald Trump doesn't meet that mark.
All right. Now, speak to those people who are mentioning Trump's name in the recent polls. And by the way, we should mention that if we turn back the clock 4 years ago, we would see that the mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani, was leading in all the polls, virtually all the polls. Some thought he was controversial. Some remembered his leadership at 9/11. What is the difference between these two candidates? They were both media darlings. Is that the only similarity?
No, I think with Giuliani, he was definitely a more serious candidate. He had a record to run on. Trump has business experience, I think, which is important in the current political discussion with the economic situation. And I think he could be a more serious candidate than maybe Dan is giving him credit for. Or today on Meet the Press, I noticed Marco Rubio kind of distancing himself from Trump as well. But I think Trump could speak to a lot of the concerns of even the Tea Party, as Tim might point out.
Well, the professional pals, I mean, mm-hmm. Lindsey Graham was on today. He was, castigating him for his use of the F-bombs and his explosion, in Las Vegas, saying some things that really were intemperate and certainly one would not expect from a presidential candidate. But, I'm not so sure that would automatically eliminate him from
consideration. What eliminates him from consideration is he supports universal health care. He supports tax increases. His solution for our trade imbalance with China is to start a trade war. I mean, this is a guy, he's asked about abortion. He has an 11th hour conversion that he's pro-life. He's asked about the right to privacy. He doesn't understand that right to privacy was the predicate for the Roe v. Wade decision.
Right.
This is somebody who hasn't done his homework. He's not serious. He hasn't given any thought to policy. And that's why he is not a serious candidate, and he shouldn't be treated as one.
Why is he doing so well in the polls?
He's doing well because he's doing what Republicans have not done to this point, in my view, which is to take the president on straight away, to really give voice to a lot of the frustration and anger that people have towards the president. But being a cipher for that frustration is not enough to be the Republican nominee for president.
I want to talk more about that. I want to get Tim's response. 1-800-723-8289. Do you agree with Dan Proft that Donald Trump is not to be taken seriously? You still believe he could be a serious candidate? And what is your reaction to the profanity-laden tirade or comments in Las Vegas? Does that disqualify him to be president of the United States? Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. Tim Krolaitis from the Tea Party in Illinois. I want to get your reaction to some of the comments that Trump has been saying lately, and whether or not you personally, whether you view him as a serious candidate, because some of the frustrations that he has been speaking sound very much like Tea Party frustrations. Mm-hmm. And my question to you is, who beats him? Who in the long list of people, whether it's Michelle Bachmann or Sarah Palin, who beats him? Who beats him who has a Tea Party identification right now?
I think there's a lot of candidates out there that'll beat him. You know,
who?
Bachmann to name one. You know,
you think Bachmann would beat Donald Trump in a primary?
Yeah, because as what Donald did just the other day with his F-bomb tantrums and everything,
Yeah.
As more and more of that gets to roll out, see, what's happening is he's the only one right now taking it to Obama. I think there's a lot of folks out there that are gravitating. He's saying some things that traditionally aren't said by media figures in the inside the Beltway.
Yeah.
And they're seeing it occur, and they're getting on the bandwagon with him. Well, when you have the other candidates step in and there's legitimate arguments being made and real issues being discussed, I think that's when he starts to reveal himself more and more as a circus clown.
Mark, your point. You think Trump is more serious than certainly Dan believes.
Yeah, I think maybe there's no candidate, including Obama, really speaking to the frustrations of the American people. I think Trump has talked a lot about protectionist trade policies, and I think a lot of Americans who've lost their jobs and seen their jobs move overseas or to other countries would be in favor of some of these things. So I think Trump, even though some of those issues, his stands on those issues would seem extreme, I think that he does voice the concerns of the American people, apart from the sideshow of the birtherism, which I think the media drove that into a frenzy. But I think Trump has policy prescriptions that are more serious than we give him credit for.
See, I think Tim is on to it, which is that Trump doesn't hold up under scrutiny. A lot of bluster right now. It's fun. It's a celebrity culture. Right. A lot of people aren't tuned into a presidential race 18 months out. But he doesn't hold up under scrutiny once you start to understand what his policy positions really are to the extent they're discernible. Once you start to understand who he's given money to over the years, including $50,000 to Rahm Emanuel, the mayor-elect of Chicago. He's given more money to Democrats. I mean, this is a guy who should be running. If he wants to run for president, that's fine. But he should be at the place where he would be more welcome, which is the Democratic Party.
But as all of this information comes out, and we go through a primary process that's going to have maybe 5-7 candidates. Who knows how many end up actually making it to Iowa or into any of these even earlier debates. Who steps forward of the group that's out there now? Who stops him? Who stops him and forces him to answer the questions that you are asking and putting on the table
this
evening?
You know, you have some serious people with also some serious campaign infrastructure in place even now, and that's with a field that hasn't rounded out yet. Mitt Romney would be one, and I'm not a huge Mitt Romney fan, but I mean, if it was Mitt Romney versus Trump, I mean, that's an easy answer. And also, too, Romney, for example, would have the financial capacity as well as, I mentioned, the political infrastructure to put a stop to that.
I think there's others. Fire?
Well, I mean, I think Romney hasn't. I mean, first of all, Trump is a huge personality, so it's hard to try and out Donald Trump, and candidates like Romney or Pawlenty or Mitch Daniels, who's my personal choice, shouldn't try and do that. Let Trump be who he is. Don't try and kind of out Trump. There's plenty of time in this process to get through this cotton candy phase and to the substantive meal, and that's where a Romney, a Daniels, perhaps a few other candidates, perhaps a Pawlenty, I think have a chance to break from the pack and avail themselves as a serious candidate on the par with the president.
But you were saying right before we went to the break, what we're saying, and something I said on this program a couple of weeks ago, and that is, whereas 4 years ago or 3 years ago now, Barack Obama used the cult of personality and media to really propel himself to win the Democratic nomination, which no one thought he could. And I'm wondering if some of those same ingredients, obviously he didn't have the negatives because most people didn't know much about him. He doesn't have the negatives that Donald Trump has, but he may have some of the other skills insofar as getting attention, and getting attention can get money, unless you don't think anybody would ever write a check to Donald Trump.
Well, I mean, I don't know, but look.
I don't think he needs one.
Yeah, I mean, well, maybe. I don't know.
What if he's running against Barack Obama?
Yeah, nobody wants to spend $1 billion of their own money, mm-hmm. including Donald Trump, probably. I think the idea of this is how Barack Obama was elected, so this is a template now, is a bad thought. That was a lottery ticket. This is not something you try and replicate, and it's not something the Republican Party should try and replicate any more than they should try and replicate what they've done in the past, which is, okay, who's next in line? And I think this is an election cycle where you have an opportunity to break from both of those bad templates.
On the question of who's next in line, it isn't just Romney, it's Huckabee. Where does Huckabee end up in all this? And is Huckabee really going to run? What are your folks saying about Mike Huckabee?
I'd say when you look at what you would say is my folks, there's the conservative side that would embrace Huckabee. But then there's also the libertarian side that said, well, look, its spending went up 60% in the state of Arkansas when he was, you know, when Huckabee was governor. So there isn't any distinct decision on any presidential candidate. I could tell you that right now. Everybody sees parts of what these people are saying as valid. Now, what's going to happen as you peel back the onion skin, as these people debate each other, as they step up and say, yeah, I'm running for president, well, that process is going to play out, and we're going to be able to determine whose rhetoric actually matches their record and who's going to go forward. So I really think the Republican primary is going to be a primary of ideas, not a personality.
One thing I noticed last night, at least in the shots that I saw where I think Trump hurt himself, is that, you know, this White House Correspondents' Dinner is, I mean, it's meant to be a roast, as you say. Generally, it's self-deprecating, mm-hmm. but it's meant as a big yuck fest, if you will. Donald Trump was stone-faced throughout all of the barbs. I mean, had he shown the ability to sort of laugh at himself, mm-hmm. I think he would have helped himself a lot more. Because, again, one of the criticisms against him is, of which there are many, is that he's very thin-skinned. He may have shown that, mm-hmm. and that's not going to go very far in a campaign.
Yeah, I think as far as likability goes, and I don't know how that's going to play in this election, because when you mentioned before the point about Obama's template and that Dan touched on, Obama's template worked really well because it was also preceded by a George Bush presidency. And I think in this case, too, Huckabee, though, I think has a very likable personality. Of the candidates in the field, he is self-deprecating and humble, and I think he resonates sort of like in a Reagan-esque way with the American people. But policy-wise, if it does become a campaign of issues, like Tim alluded to, then a Mitch Daniels or a Tim Pawlenty may move out front.
And by the way, I think the point you make about Trump and at the correspondence yesterday and how he didn't seem to enjoy any of the humor that was directed his way highlights just how unself-aware he is. I mean, he's the only guy who takes himself seriously. That's a real problem if you want to be president of the United States.
Does he... and I think it's clear that you're not a fan.
Yes.
Do you think he has the smarts, the intellectual capacity to surround himself with people that could make him more credible? Or does his arrogance prohibit him from that growth that any candidate has to make if they're going to run for president of the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any indication that he has that capacity or that desire. I mean, it's going to take more than Ivanka to get him what he needs to be serious. He has not presented a single indicia of credibility or seriousness to be the leader of the free world. Just not a single one. Nothing, in my view.
Yeah, Trump's main export is arrogance. I mean, that's his product. I mean, to lose that is to lose the brand of Trump.
And by the way, the whole business thing, you know, he's a great business person. First of all, he's a guy who was born on third and thinks he hit a triple. That's number one. Number two, four bankruptcies. Number three, I mean, one of the few people who can't run a casino for profit. So, I understand we've got the Trump Tower and he's got, you know, buildings in New York and all that. And he's worth a lot of money. But the whole Trump in his business sense and acumen to me seems to be more myth than reality.
So continuing to be out there and throw red meat, which the media will eat up, will lock him in to maybe 20% of the vote. In a Republican primary,
yeah, but I mean, remember,
but it's not going to get you the nomination.
Well, and remember, and you understand this, Bruce. Right now, you're talking about national polls. Running for president is a state by state proposition. Right. So when he doesn't move the needle in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, it's, you know, you're fired.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's sort of, but that's where the similarity goes with Rudy Giuliani.
Right.
Yeah. Very very similar. One last question on Donald Trump, and then we're going to move on to another question. And I'm going to ask everybody to come up with a name. You've mentioned Mitch Daniels. Who stops him? Because if the momentum continues to grow, and then you get a decision that Huckabee decides, you know, I like being a television commentator, and I'm not going to do it. It seems to me that Huckabee's organizational skills should be much further along than they appear to be. Mitt Romney has failed to close the sale. Mitt Romney should have had this locked up by now. He hasn't. So there's a lot of dissatisfaction for him. I mean, as all of these flawed candidates are out there, flawed by their lack of organization, their lack of charisma, or their lack of money, if there's one guy who continues to hit the benchmarks, who stops him, Tim?
Bruce, I can't tell you this early on in the process, but I'll tell you, Trump's going to stop Trump.
Okay.
Trump will stop Trump. That's the answer.
And I'll tell you one other thing. One thing George Will said about Mitch Daniels. Mitch Daniels has the charisma of competence, and that's going to be a differentiator in this election cycle.
All right. We'll see if the charisma of confidence gets people to the polls. 1-800-723-8289. From Elkton, Ohio to Boise, Idaho, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. Mark Casella was with us this evening. He is a liberal college professor. He's with Ivy Tech. That is in Indiana. Mm-hmm. And he is a teacher of radical, your assistant professor
of English.
And your area of expertise is
radical
writers.
American fiction.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about radicalism in just a few moments. Also with us this evening is conservative commentator and good friend of this program, Dan Proft. He is a long time, conservative commentator, both on this program, also working with Don Wade and Roma in the mornings on WLS, and also with Bruce Wolf on the weekends on WLS, our flagship station. Also a candidate for the Republican gubernatorial nomination in Illinois last year. And also, Tim Krolaitis joins us. He is a leader of the Illinois Tea Party movement and also a businessman, and he joins us this evening. We've got some callers on the phone that are going to talk about this issue, and then we're going to switch gears. But let's go to Long Grove, Illinois, where Darlene is listening to us. Darlene, go ahead.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen.
Hello.
What this country needs right now is a businessman. It probably is not Trump, but we need a businessman and not another politician running this country. You guys bring up Tim Pawlenty. His record in Minnesota speaks for itself. Lousy. Take a look at where the S&P index was underneath Tim Pawlenty, and it was not that good. Take a look. Mitch Daniels would sell us down the river. He has sold the hallway to Australia. He'd do anything for a dollar. We need a businessman to run this country, not a politician.
What? All right, stay on the line. Let's let Dan Proft respond.
So,
he's a Mitch Daniels fan.
So Mitch Daniels would do anything for a dollar. What do you think businessmen do? I guess my point about Mitch Daniels, yeah, he sold the Indiana Toll Road. He actually got a good deal for the state of Indiana on that.
Dan, not to interrupt you, he did not. Well, they have to pay higher taxes for dollars that are already wasted.
So here's the Mitch Daniels record over the last 6 years, 7 years now as he's been governor. Property tax reform, expansion of school choice. He has brought $11 billion in direct foreign investment into that state in the last 3 years, more than any other governor in the nation, more than any other state in the nation during that time period, including new manufacturing facilities like the Honda assembly plant in Greensburg, Indiana, and instituting health savings account with state employees, a market-based solution to health care. Here's somebody who understands where zero focus should be in this election, which is on those fiscal issues about right-sizing government and getting the American government solvent again. And he's got a track record as a chief executive over 7 years of doing very well in a tough economy.
Darlene, let's go to Mark Casella, who's our let's go to Mark Casella because he lives in Indiana. He's going to respond, and then we're going to go back to you. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, so let me give the flip side of Dan's progress that he described. So some of the progress in Indiana has been hundreds of teachers losing their jobs in Gary, Indiana, massive cuts to education to where, for example, the community college where I teach is operating on a budget that was meant to serve about 5,000 or between 3,500 and 5,000 students, now teaching about 7,500 students on that same amount of money. He's changed the time zones, created commerce and problems there. Also, as far as privatizing things, the solution's not privatizing things. It's very short-sighted to sell off your assets. We're selling American assets off to foreign countries who are going to profit when we need that money to reinvest in our own infrastructure.
Yeah, back I mean, Mitch Daniels has a 70% approval rating in Indiana after two terms. That speaks to something. People's per capita income is rising, which is the promise he made when he ran for governor in Indiana, and everybody is having to do more with less. Look at Illinois, for example, where we've had profligate spending. Those same education cuts, same education institutions having to do more with less are happening here, too, because of profligate spending. But at least Daniels was right-sizing and rethinking these big systems in government that couldn't be sustained in
the
current form.
Tim, your response, then we're going to go to Darlene for the last word.
I think he's doing a good job. I mean, where I work, one exit over is the Indiana border. And when there's signs in Indiana telling Illinois companies to relocate in there, he's doing something right that's helping actually the citizens in Indiana.
All right, Darlene, back to you. Final word.
What the gentleman just said regarding the signs in Indiana, they're all over the place. So they're the Wisconsin, as far as New Jersey, down to Florida. Jimmy John's just went down to Florida from Illinois. The issue isn't the issue is that you can't keep selling American assets off because that is short-sighted. We need to make this country grow instead of just selling everything to everybody else. So we actually need a president that thinks of this country first, and then as a businessman or as a company second, but combining them both.
Right.
And we don't have that in any of the politicians out there. Huckabee is not presidential. Romney, his time's gone. That was 4 years ago. We actually, the Republicans need someone that's strong.
But you don't think it's Trump?
No, because he's basically sliced his own throat. But we need a Trump-like person.
Let's go to Dan, listening to us in Chicago. Go ahead, you're on the air, coast to coast, listening on WLS. Go ahead, Dan. Hello, are you there? Dan, are you there? How about Rory in Austin, Texas, on KLBJ?
Hi, guys.
Yes.
I won't be surprised if one of those candidates that are very favorable by the Tea Party, such as Ron Paul or Bachman or Herman Cain, will surprise us and will start to move forward closer we get to Iowa and all those other places. I would like to hear what you think about that option.
Okay, well, I would say that not one of them will be the Republican nominee. That's my opinion. I'll let Tim Krolaitis go next.
I think where those candidates play a role is they could encourage the debate on certain important issues. And Herman Cain being one of them. We saw him here in Illinois at Right Nation. And he brought the house down. So, and again, when we talk about the process, once the process plays out, people get to see these people and they get to debate each other. That's going to drive some of the things, much like the Tea Party did. I believe some of these candidates could drive the issues in primary.
Herman Cain's a businessman. I mean, I think that one of those candidates has the potential to maybe surprise early and have a better showing than you would otherwise anticipate. But will any of them be the nominee? No, I don't think so.
Has Bachman made Palin irrelevant?
No.
I think that was Trump. I think no. Trump pushed Palin out of the media spot.
But I think
is
Palin
she going in the opposite direction though.
Well, I think
that's
Palin,
what I sense.
I think Palin has increasingly made herself not germane to the presidential contest. Not that she's not germane in the party or the conservative movement more generally, but I think it's less and less likely she'll run.
Dan, back in Chicago, are you back on the air now?
I am.
Go
Sorry
ahead.
About that. Don't know what happened. So I saw Trump the other night on C-SPAN. I hadn't heard him speak before. And, you know, the cursing aside, he absolutely makes sense about China and the issues around trade. I mean, I work for a multinational, a very large financial services company. We do a lot of business with China. I specialize in trade finance. And China does, they do think we're stupid. And we have sold out to Asia and a lot of big multinationals. That's where we see the future is. And the laws that we're, you know, putting into place here, whether it's Dodd-Frank and other things, just pushing more. It's just easier to do business in China. But he's got it right. we need somebody tough. I don't know these other candidates, but we need somebody tough who could stand up for the United States. And if that's called protectionism, I think both parties have sold us out. I really do believe that.
Is that part of the red meat that some of the Tea Party people like to hear, though? It was certainly the red meat that the Ross Perot people wanted to hear.
Yeah, well, and I'll tell you what. I got involved through another guy, actually, in the Tea Party here in Illinois. I don't go to meetings, but I went to some of the protests on this health care, met a lot of different people. I'm, you know, very diverse set of people, I'll just say that. And they do make sense. I don't agree with everything, but they make sense. And what he's saying makes sense. And
Mark,
we need
Mark's
somebody
got a comment.
Who's very
Let Mark
tough.
Casella respond, Dan.
Yeah, Dan, I think you're right on. I think Trump does articulate the concerns of many Americans. And your point about multinational corporations is really important. And the question is, whose interests do those multinationals serve? You know, should they be legislated to better serve the needs of the American people? Or do we just continue to ship those profits overseas and back to China and to other countries?
Well, look, I think the issue with Trump is I'm not necessarily saying he's not pointing to an issue. I think everybody understands how intertwined we are with China and that maybe the relationship isn't as balanced as it should be. But it's easy to identify the challenges facing the next president and facing our nation. The trick is the solutions, and that's where Trump fails to meet the mark.
But frequently, whether it's left or right, frequently voters respond to what appears to be simple solutions. Would you acknowledge that?
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, they like, and so their concept of who do I want to be – let's say they're not going to vote for Obama no matter what. Who can I envision being the president who is going to take charge and make the country a better place? And frankly, I think they make it the vision of a President Trump sitting around a big table, just like he has done on The Apprentice for the last 7 years, calling people out, chewing people out, and saying, you're fired, get out of here. I mean, I think they anticipate that that's the way he would be as president of the United States. And that's may be one reason why he's doing well in the polls.
Yeah,
they like that. His answers may not be the right answers,
right?
But somebody is taking charge, and you know what he wants to do.
Well, and it'd be up to other Republican candidates to say, you can't fire Hu Jintao.
Right. Well, yeah. That's right. Well, they got to do that. When we come back, we are switching gears. If you're calling on this subject, save your nickel. And we'll be switching gears and talking about labor relations when we continue. From Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We are going to switch gears. If you've been calling in about Donald Trump, save your, I said nickel. I don't know when you would be calling where you're calling for a nickel, but whatever you'd have to pay, we're not going to be talking about that for the rest of the show, although I don't think Donald Trump is going to go away, so there will be other opportunities to discuss that. For the rest of the broadcast this evening, we really want to take an opportunity to look at the relations of the labor movement in the United States. We talked briefly about it several months ago when Wisconsin was in the focal point of our national discussions. But this week marks the 125th anniversary of the Haymarket riots in Chicago. And many of you know about that significant moment in history. If not, we're going to share a little bit about it with our guest, Mark Casello. Because prior to that May 4th riot, which left six policemen dead and hundreds injured, there was a march. And that took place on May 1st, 125 years ago tonight. On Michigan Avenue in Chicago. And Mark, what was significant about that moment and the link to what happened 3 days later and what you think is happening in the country today because of that history?
Sure. Well, May 1st, there was a series of general strikes around the city of Chicago that had pretty much ground commerce to a halt. Trains weren't moving, freight wasn't leaving. And the strike at the McCormick Reaper Works had become really well publicized. And August Spies and Albert Parsons were part of the socialist and anarchist movement in Chicago. And August Spies had been attending a strike on May 3rd. And what happened was Chicago police had entered that strike and to disperse the crowd started shooting into the crowd, which contained women and children. And August Spies was so outraged at this act, he went back and printed materials at his newspaper office to announce the meeting of the Haymarket affair that would become the bombing, which occurred on May 4th, 1886. But it was really that general strike that was related to the eight-hour workday that has become the focus of May Day. And then the Haymarket event itself was the martyrs were honored with the May Day memorialization by the Second International in July of 1889. And so really May Day, which is May 1st today, and you'll see rallies on the news in New York City that are also joined today with immigration rallies, really emerge from a history of a movement for the eight-hour workday that was taking place around the country on May 1st.
Weren't there anti-immigrant sentiment in the country at that time as well?
Oh, absolutely. Dating back certainly to the 1850s throughout America. But really, I feel that the Haymarket and those general strikes emerge from the labor movements and strikes that have happened 10 years earlier during the rail strikes of the 1870s. But certainly, August Spies and other German immigrants were felt to have been bringing in socialist sentiment to the city. The same arguments you hear about immigration today, taking away jobs of American Native American workers, all those were part of it. But the Haymarket bombing specifically, what had happened was a dynamite bomb, an act of domestic terrorism. During the meeting, which was kind of winding down on the evening of May 4th, a bomb was thrown into the crowd. And suddenly public sentiment, which had been with the workers largely since the 1870s, began to shift because there became this terror about immigrants. There became a terror about labor and that sort of thing.
And also what followed that was as the political leadership was and as politics was emerging and people were taking sides at that particular point, it became the left and labor became linked, so much so that in the United States, May Day is not taken with the seriousness that it is around the world. I mean, May Day is a huge day all over the world, except in the United States, and the political compromise led to the celebration of labor being Labor Day. That's why we have a Labor Day, which is a long way from May 1st. But now let's bring that historic perspective to where we are today. And Dan Proft, I want to get your reaction to something that was said on the show a couple of weeks ago. And that is, and I think it's something that Mark may agree with to this evening, and that is that the recent battle up in Wisconsin, the drawing of the line with Governor Walker up in Wisconsin, that although you know there were thousands that rallied and behind the scenes in support of Governor Walker, there were thousands on the steps, and many of their political leaders say that they represent millions of labor people all over the United States, and that really what will happen now is that in 2012, that could turn out to be the spark that reignites the labor movement that in recent presidential elections has been less than a deciding factor.
I don't think so. Look, what happened in Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio, and now Massachusetts. Just this week, Massachusetts Democrats, led by the Democrat Speaker of the House of Massachusetts, passed a bill to rein in collective bargaining powers of public sector workers as it relates to negotiating for their health care benefits. What people are finding out as you get beyond the demagoguery that corrupted the conversation with what happened in Wisconsin, the siege on Madison, is that this is an arithmetic problem. It is not it's not simply about partisanship. It's not anybody – we don't like public sector workers. We hate teachers or all of this nonsensical rhetoric that, again, has corrupted the discourse. It's simply an arithmetic problem. Promises were made by politicians generations ago that were not financeable long term. And now that is, especially in a down economy, that is becoming patently evident. And people in the private sector are looking across the aisle at the public sector, what they're making, the benefit levels they have, which are more generous than what private sector workers are making, that they also have to finance. And they're saying, look, we have to draw a line. It's not that we don't like you, but nobody gets a blank check and nobody gets to live a life without risk.
We have drawn the discussion and we are going to continue the discussion. For those watching us on television, you will not get a chance to see the rest of this discussion because we're going to leave you right now. If you're listening to us on radio from coast to coast, we have another full hour. We want to get Tim to weigh in on that as well. And again, We've heard from two opposing sides. We want to know where you come down on these issues as well. 1-800-723-8029. In 2012, will labor be a focal point of the national discussion as it relates to finances, both at the national level and primarily at state levels? I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly after 5 minutes of Network News. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Our guests and fellow commentators, conservative commentator Dan Proft from our flagship station WLS Radio in Chicago, liberal professor Mark Casello, also a contributor for the Huffington Post, and Illinois Tea Party leader Tim Krolaitis. They all join us. We're talking about the labor movement and also about politics, and I want to get the thought of Tim Krolaitis, because we had our liberal and our conservative sort of discuss where the issue of labor is going to be vis-a-vis what happened in the state of Wisconsin and is happening in other states. Where does this issue of public employees and their relationship with their states, where does this fall on the Tea Party agenda, Tim?
Well, something like what happened in Wisconsin brings it to the forefront, but you'd be shocked at how many union members are also Tea Partiers.
Wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, it's amazing. What I think is...
I think Tea Party, I think of Reagan Democrats.
Yeah.
But that's one of the slices of the Tea Party
I think
loaf.
The difference is those that might lean Tea Party... that are even public sector union members see that there's a responsibility and they're willing to sacrifice. What I think we saw in Wisconsin were those that were more concerned about their own self-being and unwilling to sacrifice.
Mark, are you concerned that maybe, as was expressed by Dan Proft in hour number one, that you know there are some Democrats, including those in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, that are, as well as mayor-elect of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, that are sending signals that they may not be able to just fall lockstep behind the union, or at least the public sector unions. Are you concerned that the Democratic Party is not going to be as strong and as vociferous in making this a big issue in 2012? And maybe they don't really want to draw a line in the sand like they were doing up in Wisconsin.
Yes, the decision in Massachusetts was disappointing, but I think there is a real problem facing governments, local governments, state governments. But the question is not, I mean, Dan Proft earlier said that it was a question of math, that there's just, we've made commitments to unions that can't be continued. But what funds those public sector employees' pay? Well, it's tax revenue. And what's lacking right now? It's economic growth. Well, how do you get to economic growth? You have strong businesses that support their workers. And you have a middle class that's spending money, then the revenues return. So I think the argument to attack unions, public sector unions, it's an expedient way to solve a budget issue in the short term. But I feel like the unions are being sold down the river for political expediency.
Well, but here's the problem with that. Look, politicians of both parties are responsible for more than $1 trillion in unfunded pension liabilities at state governments, the nationwide, and that's not something that is going to be remedied overnight, even with robust economic growth in the short term. But the reality is that if you look at the data objectively, once upon a time it was public sector unions and public sector workers traded a little bit lower salaries for essentially guaranteed employment and a great benefits package. Now they have guaranteed employment and a great benefits package, and they're making more than their private sector counterparts. USA Today did a study last year of all the federal job classifications that have a commensurate position in the private sector. 8 out of 10 were making more in the public sector than in the private sector. You see this over and over and over again, and that is what people are saying, is that nobody doesn't like firefighters or cops or teachers. Nobody has anything personal against public sector workers. I worked in state and local government. I don't have any problem with public sector workers, but you have to calibrate it. You have to calibrate it so you have a government that that lives within the means of the people who are financing it. And right now, in basket case states like the one we're sitting in, Illinois and New York and California and New Jersey and a whole host of others, you have a government that simply is not living within the means of the people who are financing it, and you can't tax your way to that economic growth that you speak of.
Yeah, I think the difference you see in the wages there, though, isn't because the public sector workers are being paid, you know, astronomical amounts for doing a position. I think they're being paid a fair wage. I think workers deserve health care. But what's happened is the middle class and the wage workers in the private sector, their wages have been eroded slowly over the past 20, 30 years. Look at gas prices, $4.50 a gallon in Chicago. That's a tax every day on the American worker. And I think the question shouldn't be why are public sector workers paid so much, but why aren't private sector workers making more? And why aren't politicians passing laws that can make corporations stronger and wages stronger here in the United States?
See, I think what's ticking people off around the country is not that a public sector worker is making too much or they have a benefit. They understand, as Dan has said, that, you know, the revenue is no longer there to pay them. Mm-hmm. And something's got to give. Mm-hmm. And a perception is that those public sector people aren't willing to sort of, lower their standards, mm-hmm. take some of the same hits that non-union people take. And the perception is there's an arrogance in these public sector unions that's what people are really irate about.
They're entitled to it.
But it has become an entitlement.
But I disagree there, because in Wisconsin was the great case, because the workers had already agreed to those concessions as far as contributions to their health care. And in the end, it was still about stripping their collective bargaining rights, period. So it was the chance of future battles over these things. And it's about disarming the union's power, private or public.
And you think it's more than just private. You also think it's more than just private sector unions.
Correct.
Or the public sector unions. You think it's all unionism that they're against.
Right. Well, yeah, there's been over a century-long effort to delegitimize the unions with these questions. I mean, entrepreneurs, Carnegie at the turn of the century was making the argument that, well, it's economically unfeasible for my business to secede to these demands of the unions. And we still have that argument persisting. Today it's against public sector unions, but businesses still say the same thing. Yet American corporations are sitting on an unprecedented amount of cash.
Look, the problem with that argument is there's no collective bargaining rights for federal employees, and they seem to be making out quite well. So not allowing public sector unions to collectively bargain, which is a joke. And the difference between the private sector and public sector is in the private sector with the trade unions, for example, you actually have a true adversarial process where you have management versus labor. In the public sector, it's public sector unions that finance the people that they're going to negotiate with and then pretend when they get to the negotiating table that it's adversarial, when instead it's actually a conspiracy to rob taxpayers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
you said, by the way, in the last hour, Dan, you said that you did not think that this would be the equivalent of a political match that will start a prairie fire in 2012. Do you agree with that, Mark?
I disagree. I think we're on the cusp of a worldwide labor movement, and I think the American worker would do well to watch what's happening in other countries. In China, hasn't received much traction here in our press, but there were wildcat strikes by drivers in China regarding gas prices and fees on truck drivers. And I think we're about a decade away from a full worldwide labor movement, a rebirth of it.
Well, I think it's going to be a pivotal issue, but I don't think that it is going to resuscitate be the spark, as you said, Bruce, that resuscitates the public sector unions and their bargaining position or their standing in the public mind. But again, I want to make the distinction between trade unions and the private sector and public sector unions, because there's a big difference.
1-800-723-8029. Calls starting to come in, and we will share them with the nation when we come back from Chicago. Taking America's political pulse from coast to coast and border to border, now in our 30th year, this is Beyond the Beltway. From Monterey, California to Muncie, Indiana, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. Speaking of Muncie, let's head to Muncie, where David is listening to us on WoWo. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Dumont. I was just calling because I'm not sure that the union issue is going to, I think maybe it will be a big one, but I'm not sure that it's going to come out in the Democrats' favor. I didn't used to care that much about unions. I was just kind of indifferent. But the more I've been listening to arguments about them, the more unfavorably predisposed I've become. I mean, like, sometimes when they talk about the things that are really important that, you know, they have, are accomplishing and stuff, they talk about things like child labor laws or workplace safety, which, I don't know, I'd be important in Victorian England or something, but it just seems kind of irrelevant today. And, like, with the fight over card check or right-to-work stuff, it seems sort of anti-small-d democratic. And, I mean, there's such a small percentage of workers are in unions, and even smaller sliver of the population, that, you know, if you don't count public employees, I just find it kind of infuriating when they say things like, well, you know, we defend people who work for a living, which, you know, like, everybody else isn't or something.
Yeah, let's let our progressive professor talk about that.
No,
Mark.
So I think you bring up a good point, and that's pretty much, I think, a widespread sentiment in the country. What are unions good for me? Why should I be paying dues to somebody else? You know, my corporation's looking out for me. But here's a little story about Walmart and the meat cutters in the 90s. Walmart had one unionized position in America, and it was the meat cutters. And in the 90s, they began distributing talking points and showing videos to their workers. Hey, workers, you don't need anybody to look out for you. They said, in the meantime, they launched what was called the Case Ready Meat Program. And the Case Ready Meat Program was designed to take the meat cutter position and eliminate it from the Walmart stores and move all the meat cutting to a centralized processing facility. The management was told to explain this to the workers as more healthy. You know, the meat will be distributed on an as-needed basis, and it'll be cleaner and processed at a centralized facility. But what actually happened was they told the union meat cutters, who were making a living wage at Walmart, between $15 and $20 an hour, they said, your position no longer exists. You're now a door greeter, and those make $7 an hour. And where did the union, where did those union jobs go, and what happened? Well, it became the Postville meat processing facility that was employing many illegal immigrants here in America.
Well, here's the deal. To the caller's point, the caller is exactly right about the working families rhetoric, like people in the private sector aren't working families, and it is incendiary. And the other thing is the union, the public sector unions in particular, the manifestation of what they do, I think, is a particular turnoff to the American people. For example, in Chicago, the effort by SEIU to stop Walmarts from coming into the city of Chicago, employing people and providing, you know, food in neighborhoods that had been food deserts previously. But an even bigger one is the teachers' unions. I think the understanding that teachers' unions in urban centers across this country are bulwarks against school reform, and these systems are set up to provide benefits and jobs for the adults in the system, irrespective of the outputs that these systems are providing, particularly with something as critical as the education of our children. I think that, it, along with the sense of entitlement, along with the incendiary rhetoric, has really put public sector unions in particular at odds with the sentiments of the American people. And that's probably a good thing because they control monopolies that should be broken up.
Would
and
the
teachers'
union
is a good example of that.
Would you acknowledge that some of the reforms, bipartisan reforms that recently passed in Springfield, Illinois, that the unions were involved in weighing in on that? And by the way, can you share that story with the national audience?
Well, I mean,
it was sort of a groundbreaking political development.
In Illinois, you know, maybe as opposed to the rest of the nation, you know, even reforms aren't really reforms. Here you had some baby steps on a journey of 1,000 miles with respect to teacher tenure reform, with respect to right to strike for teachers unions in particular. But what this really is the teachers unions trying to stave off a conversation they don't want to have. The larger conversation about school choice, for example, or the expansion of charter schools, or eliminating teacher tenure altogether. So they concede on the margins so that everybody can run out and tout reform like we were all part of this, so they can stave off the real conversation that needs to be had.
Do you also, again, for those listening around the country, we have a mayor-elect in Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, who during his campaign said that there was going to be some significant belt tightening. He has spoken, brought in a new leader of the Chicago Public Schools, a controversial figure. Are you believing him when he is rattling his sabers about dramatic changes in the Chicago public school system as it relates to a number of the issues we've talked about this evening?
Yeah, no, I'm very skeptical. I think a lot of these reforms, particularly, again, in Illinois, and we're the bad example, so I'm not saying this is the same in every other state, but a lot of these reforms are window dressing. The one thing I will say, though, which I'm guardedly optimistic about, is it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter Republican, Democrat. It doesn't matter if they want to settle for window dressing or not. The arithmetic is unyielding. And so Rahm Emanuel is going to have to deal with the city of Chicago, which is on the verge of bankruptcy, just like mayors in most of our other urban centers are dealing with the same issues, and they relate to personnel costs, and that means public sector union reform.
Dan in Belleville, Illinois, I think wants to weigh in on this subject. Go ahead. You're on the air, Dan.
Yes, I sure do. It's specifically from Mr. Propp. You know, the one thing that I hear out of conservatives, I say Republicans in general, over and over again, is how the public employees in the various states, not just in Illinois, but the others as well, who are members of unions, and those who are a member of non-unions, have to bite the bullet on the pension reform issue and settle with less. Well, my only comment to that is that it's common knowledge, and Propp knows that himself. I don't even have to even think about it, is that many people, especially professionals like myself, who've made the decision to make a career in government way back. We did that in exchange for lesser compensation, but for secure benefits programs, which includes pensions and health care and things of that nature. Now, the most important part is there is a provision in almost all these state constitutions, Illinois in particular, that existing employees shall not see. This is in the Constitution, not in a statute, that their pension benefits shall not be diminished. And, you know, the Republicans are trying to get around that now. And the reason why that provision was put in the case of Illinois, and I'm just using Illinois as an example, it applies in Ohio, applies in Wisconsin, is because back in the early 70s when they had the Constitutional Convention, need I remind Mr. Propp that the funding for state pensions at that level was only 47%. Well, right now, it's only 51%. Why weren't these pension funds funded by the legislatures and the governors over the last 30-some-odd years, both Democrat and Republican alike? Mr. Propp, you've got some answering to do. Didn't do it. They neglected it, and now, when the situation is bad, let's blame it all on the state employees.
Well,
you know what?
Yeah.
I think it stinks.
Well, look, you'd be surprised how much I agree with you. I'm the one who's I said, and I'll say it again, so to be explicit, politicians made promises that they didn't go about keeping. Democrats and Republicans in Illinois, being the state with the largest unfunded pension liability, the state with the lowest funded pensions, is, again, the bad example, as we are on so many other scores. So I don't blame state workers. And the other thing I would say is I believe the state governments should keep their promises, even the bad ones, because, as you say, people relied on those promises, and it's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. Here's where we might have a difference. And then this goes to the constitutional provisions you're talking about. Pension reform, for me, needs to include setting a date certain for benefits not yet accrued by public sector workers where you strike a new deal. So for the time that you've worked and the benefits that you've accrued, you are owed those benefits. I agree 100%. But on a go-forward basis with a bright line drawn so everybody knows that on a date certain there's going to be a new deal for everybody, that is where the reform needs to get to. It can't just be for new hires. It's also got to be for existing employees for benefits not yet accrued.
Mark's got a comment. Mark's got a comment, and then we'll go back to you. Mark?
Okay. Yeah.
I would say an acceptable compromise is some people that are at least figuring the average state worker, especially since, you know, you do know that in Illinois and several other states where they also participate in Social Security, it's not like Chicago and other locations where it's a high rate of return. It's only 1.67% per year.
Mark, go ahead.
Okay. So one thing that's important, the only reason we're having this conversation about the pension benefits and why they haven't been suspended is because there are public sector unions. In the private sector, captain like Sullenberger, who was an airline pilot who landed his plane in the river, right?
Yeah.
You remember him?
Safely.
Safely in the river, right? And his pensions disbanded. In the private sector, there's nothing standing between eliminating pension benefits. It's those unions that are necessary to protect those workers. And Dan even agreed and conceded on the point that these obligations should be met, at least for the workers where they've been promised earlier.
Agree. I mean, I look, people rely on a promise. A government should keep its promises. That's a simple principle. But
I agree with that.
But stop making promises. Stop making promises you can't keep. And it's very easy for politicians to promise public sector unions the world to curry their favor, knowing that it's going to be somebody else that has to pay. Well, the somebody else down the road that has to pay is us now. And so my point is, get people around a table and say, on a date certain, there's got to be a new deal struck. And to the extent public sector unions want to continue to subsist and enjoy any popular support, they should be constructive in trying to forge a new deal that we can finance.
Right, and they walk to the future with their eyes wide open.
And Bruce, just to mention, you know, when we talked about the union members that are involved in the Tea Party mm-hmm. movement, they see that they're all about government accountability. They're all about, you know, why isn't our pension? Why aren't the obligations that you made to us, the promises? Why aren't they fulfilled? You know, and on a larger level, we can look at that federally. Why is our Social Security system in the shape that it's in? It all comes back to an accountability of our government to the people. Okay? So politics makes strange bedfellows sometimes.
No, can I say one
you
more
thing? 10 seconds.
One more thing really quick. You know, public sector unions, 95% support the Democrats.
Right.
And in most of these cases, like in Illinois, it's been Democrats that have not been keeping the promises by funding these pensions. So my message to public sector unions and those employees, if you want to stop being lied to, stop financing liars.
Back shortly from Chicago. From Alamogordo, New Mexico, to the Hamptons in New York, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Around the table, our progressive, liberal, left-wing guest is Mark Casello, and he's very proud of all of those labels. He is a contributor for the Huffington Post, and by the way, his article on the issue of the Haymarket riot is going to be on, and the whole movement that really led this discussion this evening. It's the 125th anniversary of the Haymarket riot and what began in Chicago 125 years ago tonight, 3 days in advance of the riot, is one of the reasons why we're having this discussion. But again, you can read more about it on Huffington Post. Mark is also an assistant professor of English, primarily focusing on radical writers, radical American writers. So he's got this thing for radical Americans that he likes to talk about, and we're talking about it this evening. He is from Ivy Tech in Bloomington, Indiana. Illinois Tea Party leader Tim Krolaitis also joins us, and conservative political commentator Dan Pfaff from WLS Radio and a Republican candidate for governor in the recent primary in Illinois. He was unsuccessful, but he is back on the air on the weekdays with our good friend Bruce Wolf.
Weekends.
You're not weekdays yet.
No. Working on that.
working on that with your agent. You're working on that right now. By the way, we wanted to make a point because before the break we talked about when the trust was broken between states, and the caller was talking about all states and all legislatures that basically have started to back away. And Dan Pfaff was making a point about that in Illinois, under Democratic leadership, a lot of that has happened because of the leadership of the General Assembly, primarily for much of the last 35 or 40 years. But again, during the break, I wanted to mention this, that really when you look from a gubernatorial level, the governor of Illinois, who started the process of basically saying that it was okay not to put the money into the pensions to keep faith, was a Republican governor, Jim Edgar.
Yeah,
and no, you acknowledge
that's
that.
Correct. Yeah, I said it's not.
So it's
Republicans and Democrats, right, okay. but it's been predominantly Democrats.
Let us go to Mike, listening in a car phone on WLS, our flagship station. And I understand you are pro-labor.
I am a business owner. In fact, I just crossed into Wisconsin to go to my business so I could get there on time to open up tomorrow.
You didn't move your business to Wisconsin, though, did you?
Indirectly, an opportunity came along, and myself and a couple other guys grabbed it, yes.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I didn't move it from Illinois. Well, no.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, so it's a long-winded story, but as I said, I am also a liberal. I don't even call myself a progressive because the liberal term became pejorative someplace along the line, and I never gave it up. Dan, I believe, is the guy who just said you shouldn't hire people who are lying to you in simple arithmetic. Dan, you are very correct. We need to get the money back from the extremely rich people. The gap between rich and poor, as you said, it's simple, simple arithmetic, has grown exponentially. That's the problem. Last December, when people in Washington came back after the election, they extended, broke a promise to let the tax rates go back to where they were. Nobody got a raise in taxes. And they basically gave the rich people that back after we didn't pay for a war for almost 10 years. And Mr. Bush put off the books. Mm-hmm. He lied about it. They weren't on the books. That's where a lot of the deficit came from. So you're correct. People have been lied to for a long time. We keep giving the rich money they don't deserve. That's not socialism. That's equity. That's my point.
All right.
And, if you want to do some arithmetic, by the way, I have a master's degree in taxation.
Okay. Well, I guess
Mike, we're going to go. We're going to go back. We'll give you the last word, but we have a couple of guests that are chomping at the bit to respond.
Well, I'm reticent to respond after he agreed with me, but kind of for the wrong reason. So, if you're good at arithmetic, explain this one to me. If we confiscated the wealth of everybody in this country who makes more than $250,000, I mean, took it all because, as you say,
I make way more than $250,000.
Okay, so if we confiscated your wealth and everybody else who makes over $250,000, we would fund the federal government at its current spending levels for 90 days. So my question to you is, after you do that, because they don't deserve their money, what are we going to do in August?
Okay, I'll tell you what we're going to do in August. The so-called capital gains, if I put $1 million into the stock market in New York, spread it around, GE, McDonald's, Walmart, all the great companies, okay? That's about as much putting – how many jobs did I create? The answer, the arithmetic, zero. There's never been a single job created on a single transaction done on the New York Stock Exchange, and yet they cry that that's capital and it should be taxed at 15%. It should be taxed at 50%. Because as a Republican, you should know, why would we reward people for not working? Because when you put that money in the New York Stock Exchange, the speculative market, you're not working. You're creating the job. You're not investing. That money goes into a big black called speculation. Am I right or wrong?
You're wrong, but I'll let Mark go first.
No,
Tim's going.
If you read the opening paragraph to the New York Stock Exchange, a self-regulatory organization, it is the secondary market. Not $1 that goes to the New York Stock Exchange has ever created a job in America since its history opened back in the 1800s.
Tim Krolaitis is what from the Tea Party wants to comment.
I'm just a little disturbed that you're willing to look at your fellow citizens and blame it on the rich when a lot of times it's the government.
A great,
well, if you want to take it from them, it's almost like, you know, why don't you get the rhetoric and the accountability on the people that actually didn't do what they were going to say, which is the government. And 90% of the voting base of those people you're voting for the same people that are robbing you.
Okay.
I'm not voting for the same people that are robbing me. The people that are robbing me are the people on Wall Street. As I said, I have a master's degree in taxation.
I'm impressed. I don't.
Where do you think the code came from? The code came from people walking into people in Washington, giving them money and saying, write this piece of crap because there's nothing to do with any common sense.
No, I couldn't agree more with the caller. And the point I wanted to make was he's right. A 50% tax rate above $1 million is probably fine. And those people will be just as rich.
I don't earn money. I so-called capital gains, which are not capital gains.
Right. But also, I mean, think about ExxonMobil. Their first quarter earnings, 69% up, $10.7 billion. All right. And how much of that is taxed? And how much of that is going to create jobs? Is going back to the American workers? Zero.
Mike, what kind of business are you in generally? What kind of business what do you manufacture?
I started out in the tax business. I worked down in the LaSalle Street markets, and now I buy and sell businesses, believe it or not.
You buy and sell businesses?
Yeah.
Okay.
Does he downsize them when you buy them?
He hates
them. No, right now, as a matter of fact, what I have a manufacturing firm. We're 7 years into it. I enjoy it so much. And you know what the best thing is? I have no union employees. Employee benefits are more than my rent overhead. I ran overhead $1 million, and I put out more in employee benefits, and I am so happy to do that.
That's good. You're a great American.
Yeah, so we don't need the public sector.
I'm not a great American. No, I'm not a great American. I'm fair. You know what I am? You know what I am?
What's that?
I'm a guy who was raised right, who said, you know, whatever you do to the least of my brother. That's right. Pretty much
exactly.
It.
Exactly. Thank you for living
that. Mike, thanks for your call. Call again. It's good to hear from you.
New York Stock Exchange, 50% because there is no capital.
Right. Exactly.
Let's go to Tom, listening to us in Indianapolis. He's going to weigh in. Are you weighing in on Mitch Daniels or on some other issue?
Well, first of all, I want to weigh in on Mike. Mike, you're an idiot, okay? I mean, I don't know where you get your masters from, but I, too, make over $250, and I don't want my taxes raised. That's the most idiot thing I've ever heard in my whole entire life, you know? And your private's a corporate raider in the first place. What an idiot. I don't care if you got a master's in taxation or not.
Well,
that's okay.
Here's my.
I'm just very impressed that the demographics of this show have so many people making over $250,000 a year.
And have masters.
I think we're gonna have to raise our advertising rates.
Well, I don't have a master's. You don't need a master's to make $250,000 a year. Give me a break.
Yeah.
Go
ahead. I'm sorry.
I want to take Mr. Prop to task, and I apologize, Dan, but you made a statement earlier that you know the union members, okay. The people getting the pensions today should not be blamed. A promise should be kept. However, what you're missing is that those promises were made, okay, out of extortion of the politicians for their votes. In other words, you know, the unions say, look, you vote for us, okay, or you do what we want, you give us the pensions we want, you give our sweetheart deals to us, and then we're going to vote for you. If you don't, then we're not going to vote for you. In fact, we're going to kick you out of office. That's extortion.
Well, look. I agree with you. I said that you know the problem in the public sector is collective bargaining is a myth because there's not a true adversarial process. It's the public sector unions are on both sides of the deal. They're negotiating with themselves. So I agree with you. However, when you're talking about deals that are struck at the leadership level that affect, like in the state of Illinois, for example, you know upwards of 60,000 employees, I don't think it's right when somebody who's making 35 grand in some agency who took that job on the basis that this was going to be the compensation package and then has the rug pulled out from underneath them 25 years later. That's not right either. So my point is to say there are a lot of bad promises made. There's a system that's corrupt, which I totally agree with, but you have to honor your promises as the means to get to the go forward point where you strike a new deal. That I'm just trying to be practical.
But you're asking the promises to be honored or the promises to be honored by the tax dollars. I mean, these are promises made by corrupt politicians, okay, who were extorted to vote for these pension plans, and now you're asking the taxpayers who had nothing to do with it whatsoever to now support these out-of-control pensions.
Look, I understand your point. The other thing I would say in Illinois, as a previous caller made the point, and in other states, there is a constitutional prohibition against negotiating after the fact in terms of trying to claw back benefits already accrued. I think it's perfectly constitutional to strike a new deal on a go-forward basis for benefits not yet accrued, and that's just where I draw the line as a matter of practicality.
On that note, we have to pause. 1-800-723-8029. We have touched a nerve, as you can imagine. We have people listening all over the country. They're driving. They're on the internet. They're listening to radio. They're listening to satellite radio. A couple of people have picked us up from the pigeons that we have flying with our messages. 1-800-723-82. A couple of people with a Dixie cup and a string, I understand, listening in this evening. Back shortly from Chicago. 1-800-723-8029. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Before we go, I just want to take a moment to everybody listening this evening, many on WLS, but primarily on WAPI out of Birmingham, Alabama, one of our longtime affiliates on Beyond the Beltway. I know many people within the sound of that station have gone through a horrendous period in your personal lives, many listening in Georgia as well. And so our prayers go out to all those who have lost lives as well as significant property damage. And it is one of those things that happens in life that, unfortunately, it's happening too often. And we around the United States, when we see the pictures like we have seen from Alabama or we have seen from around the world, we tend to sort of dig deep and we want to help people who are less fortunate, who are victims of tragedies like we've seen. And we all know of America's generosity when those in need are far away from our American shores. This past week, we have seen Americans, again, lose their lives, lose their livelihood. Their lives will never be the same again. Many of them are surviving, even though they have perhaps lost loved ones. And there are many charities. I'm not going to focus on a particular charity. You know the ones, whether it's the Red Cross or the Salvation Army, or if you were to do any kind of a Google search on the variety of charities that are doing work in helping the lives of those in Alabama and in Georgia survive and recover from what transpired last week. I ask you to do that. I remember them in your prayers, and if you've got a little extra money, I'm sure that they would appreciate that as well. But again, to those listening on WAPI, you've been a long time good affiliate of this program, and again, our prayers are with you and your listeners tonight. Let's go to Dan, listening to us in Mount Prospect on WLS.
Hi. I'm amazed that I have been called upon because I had dinner. I'm one of those guys in the middle.
You had dinner while you were waiting to be on the program?
Yeah, I've been on for about 40 minutes.
Oh,
anyhow, I heard,
what'd you have for dinner?
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
I heard the 250,000-plus guys and I heard the union guys. Yeah. I sort of fall in the middle. I'm 67, worked for myself for over 50 years. And the difference with me is being self-employed, as you guys know, or maybe you don't, I pay double Social Security. Also, you may not know this, I don't qualify for unemployment. Also, I would guess that Kraft would know this, I have no guaranteed pension. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you do know teachers don't pay any Social Security. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so my point is, how about all my buddies, which probably in the Chicagoland area amount to 500,000, we don't care about the unions and we don't care about the $250,000 guys. We just do business every day. So when I make $100,000, at that point I'm paying close to $13,000 in social. So if you guys are making $500,000, if you consider that my taxes, I'm in a higher tax bracket than you guys are.
Yeah, look, I think your point is a great one, and this goes back to the whole kind of working families rhetoric and who that rightly applies to, and it also goes to
but,
a lot.
But nobody, Dan, nobody talks to us. I mean, again, at my age, I don't
know. That's a great point.
Yeah, it's
sort of beneath me. Nobody talks to us.
Yeah, one of the
I make less. If I was a union carpenter, I'd be making my $90,000. The difference is when I'm not employed, like some of my buddies, I'm not allowed to go get a job. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So last year, I don't know, maybe I made $40,000. Yeah. It was tough, but nobody told me what to do.
Yeah.
But nobody hits upon the fact that I pay double Social Security. Are the other gentlemen aware of that or not?
Yeah, Mark. Yeah.
No, I think...
Okay, well, how do you qualify that when the teacher pays none?
Yeah, well... I think you have a great point. I'm a former small business owner, and those costs are destructive to small business. But you're a self-employed, self-proprietor, right? And I think that's a good point. I mean, that's why you hear conversations even about raising the cap on Social Security contributions above the $100,000, $107,000 mark. But, yeah, I mean, the Tea Party could probably put some pressure to do those sorts of things that would give you some relief, I think.
Well, I think there's a risk-reward scenario when you enter into an entrepreneurial-type business. And every day, the reward side of that equation seems to be chipped away.
Mark in Austin, Texas on KLBJ. Go ahead.
Thank you. Wow. Social Security. Talk about promises not kept. we have elected and reelected politicians who have in front of television cameras a many. Many of them they rush to get in front of have spent that money. That money is gone. The pension funds of these public employees were gambled in collateralized debt obligations that were then the American taxpayer, union members, and everybody were hooked up to bail out institutions that were deemed, as we were told by Bush and Obama too, and senators along the way, that were too big to fail, that nonetheless, at the time, they were already insolvent. So the American taxpayer has been hooked up, whether he's a union member or not, to this endless cycle of paying an endless debt which can never be repaid, and it's called interest. And we're all being sucked dry and pit upon one another, in my view, and employees of a public sector and private sector are being used as a scapegoat to divert the real issue, which in my mind is, why are we sitting here and borrowing money and allowing politicians to hand out those borrowed monies with interest that can never be paid generation after generation after all of us are gone? into a system that is fundamentally broken, but nobody talks about, and that is very simply this. The American bank that is owned by a private cartel that is known as the Federal Reserve System. Why don't we talk about this?
We will at some point, but you ask a significant question with the theme already rolling, so it is rhetorical tonight, but we'll pick up on that subject. And again, based on the number of calls this evening, obviously people want to talk a lot about this because it is tied to the one thing we all want in life called security. And our thanks this evening to Mark Casello. He is a contributor to Huffington Post. Dan Proft, he is a contributor to WLS Radio. And Tea Party leader Tim Krolaitis, he is a contributor to the Krolaitis Family Endowment Fund. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. It's a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.